think for a second, right? We use the word Judeo-Christian as if it's like theologically coherent.
Welcome to Respecting Religion, a BJC podcast series where we talk about what's at stake for faith, freedom for all in 2020. I'm Amanda Tyler, Executive Director of BJC.
And I'm General Counsel Holly Holman.
This week, we'll listen in on a recent conversation between two leading voices for interfaith collaboration. Eboo Patel, founder and president of Interfaith Youth Corps, offers some personal reflections on what it's like to be a Muslim in America today, including raising Muslim children, and how he's optimistic about religious pluralism.
But first, we'll catch up on how we've been seeing religion respected in the world around us in the past week.
Hi, Holly. Good to see you on Zoom again this week.
Hey, Amanda. It's nice to see you. How was your Passover Seder?
Yeah, that was our conversation last week. It was wonderful. You know, it in this time that can often feel pretty bleak, that evening was a real highlight, not just for my nuclear family here sheltered in place in our apartment, but our broader family all across the country. We had people joining from three time zones, like seven cities.
Your husband's extended family for this event and your very first time hosting, right?
That's right. So my husband's extended family came, some of my family came. It was really beautiful. We read from the Haggadah, the service, and everybody, my husband led, and everyone had a part. And then for my house, I had made at least part of the traditional Seder dinner, which took all day, but was kind of a nice diversion, I think, from our current reality, and it made it feel special. And the highest praise I got was from my five-year-old, who told me at the end, "This was the best Seder ever, Mom." So
that's great.
That's a win.
That's a total win.
Yeah.
That's great.
Well, how was your holiday weekend, Holly?
Well, I celebrated Easter with our church family via video, like so many people. So it was a really unusual time. It was a nice service. Our church, like many, have kind of adapted to this online services, splicing in readings from different members and trying to follow the worship service as well as we can at a distance, including having our music ministry play the piano from their home and lead singing. That part's a little funny, where you're listening to your music minister sing and say, "Everyone sing with us." And in my household, we weren't playing the full choir, but anyway, there were some
you tried at least.
There were some light moments, and you know, it was a nice service. Very obvious that we're missing our routine and missing celebrating special events in gatherings. So as well as we're doing, it's a poor substitute for being together.
Yeah, I have to give my church credit. The music ministry, they reached out to the members of the choir and asked them each to record their part of singing Handel's Messiah. And
wow.
Then someone edited that all together and they played it and they asked us to stand in our houses, you know, while this, and it was really remarkable. But I had that feeling of kind of watching myself thinking, this is not the same thing, but props for creativity and for effort to really try to recreate that glorious moment.
There's a lot of hope in that. And yeah, along with holding up those first responders, the medical people, the grocery store workers, we should be holding up these congregational leaders because they are doing a great job for us, even though they know that we are all hurting and not being able to experience things the way we normally do.
Yeah. And trying to provide that bit of hope in a time that can sometimes feel pretty dark.
Yes.
An Easter experience in a world that right now feels a lot more like Good Friday for us. And so as we talk about respecting religion and what we're seeing in our world around us, the news we're seeing right now is feeling pretty sad.
I would agree. The COVID news just continues in all these sad and complex ways that we've witnessed in the last few weeks. And while we want to celebrate the creativity and connectedness that we can find, it is sometimes overwhelming to just recognize, just to look at, which we all should and must, at the reality and the continuing uptick in numbers of infections and death. And I was particularly struck by the opinion piece in the Washington Post recently by Michelle Norris, where she was talking about how, you know, people, not only are they dying alone, but then you cannot have, you know, funerals, you can't have gatherings in a way that is so important to people as they grieve deaths and kind of work through the grief, that, you know, the funeral gathering, and I can say, you know, just from my personal experience, while that is not at all the, you know, it's not something to wrap things up and tie a bow on a terrible experience of losing someone, it does help to have people gather and be together and share their grief and tell stories about a person so that you can sort of celebrate the whole picture instead of just the focus on the sadness of death. The piece was called "The Coronavirus is Depriving People of the Rituals Needed to Process Pain."
Well, just taking a moment to kind of remember those who are who have lost their loved ones. We hear the figures, we see the numbers, we see the chart, and we think about that happening on an individual basis for all of those people across the country and the world right now, and how difficult it is for them.
It is. And I think we'll just continue in these struggles personally with the loss, but also trying to continue to find ways to adapt and substitute our normal rituals and special religious occasions, you know, with different practices during this time of social distancing. And that'll be important because there are some important other religious holidays on the horizon, right?
Yeah, right. Later this month, our Muslim friends will celebrate Ramadan and will find other ways to have their community iftars each night as they break fast. And, you know, Holly, you and I have talked about how one good outcome of our particular situation is that we are gaining new respect for other religions. We're learning more about religious practice. And
right.
I learned this week, thanks to Religion News Service and an article they did, that the Sikh community is celebrating Vaisakhi this week. I also learned how to pronounce Vaisakhi. And this is one of their major holidays or celebrations throughout the year. And so that they're turning to online ways to celebrate as well. And we'll put a link to in the show notes to that article, so our listeners can also maybe learn more about the religious practices of our Sikh neighbors during this time.
So speaking of religious pluralism, we're excited to bring one of our country's experts on interfaith work to our Respecting Religion podcast.
Yeah, so just before we started getting the directives and really understanding how rapidly the coronavirus was spreading through our country, BJC held one of our last, we held our last public event at BJC on March 5th in Dallas, Texas. We have an annual lecture series called the Sherden Lectures. The official name is the Walter B. and K.W. Sherden Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State. This year, the Sherden Lectures were on the campus of Southern Methodist University, or SMU, in Dallas, Texas. And our speaker was Eboo Patel, who's the founder and president of Interfaith Youth Corps, which also goes by IFYC. IFYC works to make interfaith cooperation a social norm in our country. And Eboo Patel spoke on the SMU campus, and our lectures this year were co-sponsored by the Baptist House of Studies at the Perkins School of Theology at SMU.
Yeah, that's so exciting that the Sheridan Lectures were at SMU, because that was a first. We host at different university campuses each year.
Yeah, and this is the first year of the Baptist House of Studies, and so it was a good opportunity for us to bring our collaboration to that campus. Our friend, the Reverend Dr. Jamie Clark Soles, who is a New Testament professor at Perkins, is leading the Baptist House of Studies. It's a virtual house that fosters community for ministerial students, faculty, and staff who identify with the Baptist and Free Church traditions there at Perkins and on the broader SMU campus.
Well, of course, the lectures are named after Buddy and Kay Sheridan, Dr. Walter B. Sheridan, and Dr. K.W. Sheridan of Macon, Georgia. So these are great friends of BJC, great advocates for religious liberty, both extremely accomplished teachers in their own right. And they established this lectureship because they wanted to advance religious liberty through education by taking the message, BJC's message for religious liberty, and bringing in other experts onto college campuses to excite students and that kind of university environment. So both of them are wonderful givers, obviously, to give their time and money to BJC and start this lectureship. So we're profoundly grateful for their gift.
And their gift, they wanted to see the impact of their gift in their lifetime. And they certainly have. This year was our 15th annual Sheridan Lecture. And so they have brought 15 years of experts to college campuses.
They have. And the BJC website lists all of those lectures that describe the series. You can hear many of the lectures. You can learn more about the Sheridans. And we are so excited that today we can actually take you to the Sheridan Lectures at SMU.
They're going to listen in on this conversation between Eboo Patel and the Reverend Dr. George Mason, who is pastor of Wilshire Baptist Church in Dallas, Texas, and also the founder and president of Faith Commons, a multi-faith, multi-ethnic nonprofit committed to promoting the common good. And people can learn more about Faith Commons at faithcommons.org. They can also learn and view videos of these Sheridan Lectures at bjconline.org/Sheridan Lectures. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, you'll hear George Mason speak with Eboo Patel and talk about his work at IFYC and also his personal story about the importance of interfaith work.
Today, you really stimulated our thinking, I think, about the religious roots of this work. Not just the civic aspect, but the religious aspect, Eboo. Getting to the practical is really important. It occurs to me that the religious aspect of this for us Baptists, you mentioned our early sources. But, you know, part of what's happening in this Baptist house is that we're really returning to those early sources. We actually regressed toward when we became plentiful in the South, especially, Baptists sort of forgot that we had these principles to begin with because it was easier for us to act with a majoritarian consciousness, you know. So a lot of what we're doing in this Baptist house and in this work with the BJC, who has always reminded us of this, is this principled sense of defending our neighbors and reaching out. Which raises the question, though, I think, about the work you do with Interfaith Youth Corps. And when you find young people and you're working on a faith-based approach with them, the developing faith of young people seems to go through different phases, and also sometimes the way it comes about, it either seems to reflect the families and religious traditions they grew up in, or react strongly against them, right? Or they become more of a response to the larger culture they perceive to be going. Where are we now in America as you perceive that when you're working with young people and as we think in our congregations about this work? Do you have a sense of what this moment is that you're working in? Yeah, I have no idea.
Okay.
Which I think actually is, which is a very, it's a molten moment.
Yeah.
Right? What's the line? All that is solid melts into air. Uh-huh. Right? My friend Valerie Kaur has a line, are we in the darkness of the tomb or the darkness of the womb? Right? Is everything dying? Right. Or is something waiting to be reborn?
Right.
So I wish I was smart enough to say that. Actually, it's probably not for me to say. Right. And so I'm glad that she came up with it, but I'm glad I can quote it. So I'll tell you about another moment in American history that might that I imagine in the moment felt like how we're feeling now, but of course in retrospect feels very tied up and coherent and cohesive. Right. So this is the story of how the term Judeo-Christian comes to America. It's a story that I tell in the book Out of Many Fates. But sometimes when I open my talks, especially to college first years, I'll say, you know, when the pilgrims arrived on the eastern seaboard and they dusted off Plymouth Rock, they saw the words Judeo-Christian nation etched on the stone, right? And all these kids with like perfect SATs will like look at me and they'll be like, did I get that question wrong in the standardized? I'll be like, it's a joke, you know? And of course, it raises the question. It's kind of funny. But of course, the story of where Judeo-Christian nation comes from is something that the vast majority of highly educated people actually don't know. And it's an even better story than the story of etched in the stone on Plymouth Rock, right? Because I think it's a story that gives us hope for this moment, and one that has the virtue of being true. So the 1920s is an era that is actually not unlike our own, right? Great amounts of wealth being made in certain quarters, vast income inequality, huge amounts of immigration, massive economic shift from the agrarian economy to the industrial economy that's accompanied by massive social shifts. So 1920 is the first year that more Americans live in cities than live in the countryside. When you think about the shifts that emerge in the family as a result of that, et cetera, it's huge. When Max Weber was shown Chicago in the late 19th, early 20th century, he said, it looks like a man with his skin peeled off. Right? That's how kind of crazy cities were in the late 19th, early 20th century. So it's an era of huge, huge, huge shifts. And one of the things that accompanies huge, huge shifts is racist movements. So the KKK has a resurgence in the 1920s. This is either the second or third chapter of the KKK. And in addition to being just violently, invariably anti-black in terms of its racism, it's also anti-Jewish and anti-Catholic. It numbers 3 to 4 million Americans, which is not a small number considering American demographics in the 1920s. In any case, so they're growing, growing, growing. They're targeting African-Americans, Jews, Catholics. These aren't Americans. We're a Protestant nation, et cetera, et cetera. Protestant white nation, et cetera, et cetera. 1928, a man runs for president named Al Smith. He's the governor of New York. He is also the first Catholic to run on a major party ticket. And the KKK basically torches his campaign. Says, if Al Smith wins, he will send a one-word telegram to the Pope, unpack. Al Smith opened, I think it was the Lincoln Tunnel that opens in New York under Al Smith's governorship. And people say, he opened the tunnel to sneak the Pope into America, right, et cetera. The kinds of things that kind of sound crazy today, but then torpedoed a presidential campaign in 1928. So after that happens, a group of people who've been involved in ecumenical work in the 1920s in kind of local ways, right, they gather together at the national level, a group of rabbis, Protestant pastors, Catholic priests, and lay people, and they call themselves the NCCJ, National Conference for Christians and Jews, changed its name couple decades ago to the National Conference for Community and Justice. And they say, we cannot be a nation that excludes the contributions of Jews and Catholics. They don't take on the most important exclusion in America, which is race. They take on anti-Semitism and anti-Catholicism, and they do local events like this, right? They do what they call tri-faith dialogues. They send speakers across the nation, trialogues, right? Pastors, priests, rabbis to talk about the brotherhood of man under the fatherhood of God. It's the lead up to World War II, and so they make visits to American military bases, and of course, part of what America is doing is saying, we, beautiful, diverse America, are not like you racist Nazis, right? Well, I mean, there's a little bit of irony to that, especially considering this is America in the 1930s, but in the lead up to this war, there's this contrast being made, and the NCCJ fits right into the American ethos around the war. They're doing all of these local civic projects, and they increasingly realize it's just not going to be enough, right? It's super important, but it's not going to be enough because there is a myth in America of us being a white Protestant nation. We need to change the myth. We need to change the narrative. So you know what they do? They make up a term. They invent it. Think for a second, right? We use the word Judeo-Christian as if it's like theologically coherent. Okay. So if you're a Christian in this room, Jesus is at the center of your faith life. Son of the living God, Lord and Savior. If you're Jewish, Jesus is a good rabbi. Maybe. Discuss. Right? I mean, seriously, that's not a joke. That's like, right? I mean, how is the term Judeo-Christian theologically coherent? It is not. How historically accurate is the term Judeo-Christian? Well, Jews didn't do that great in Christendom for the last millennia, right? Last 100 years in America, not so bad. Not terrible. Last millennia, not so well. It's not an especially historically accurate term. So what is its utility? It is a brilliant civic invention. It is absolutely genius because it sends the message, we are a nation that welcomes the contributions of Jews and Catholics and doesn't violate their dignity. Don't you know we're a Judeo-Christian nation? You can't be anti-Catholic. Don't you know we're a Judeo-Christian nation? You can't be anti-Semitic, right? It's a new narrative, and it was literally invented less than 100 years ago, and it's invented in a moment that felt probably darker than this moment feels, at least to some of us right now. So I actually think that this is this molten moment in which there's all kinds of narratives that are playing for what's going to last for the next 50 years. And if you think about just, if you're kind of Obama-leaning in the way that I am, one of the big mistakes that people like me made, maybe I'm the only one in the nation, but I would doubt it, right? We thought that the zeitgeist was the telos. Mm-hmm. Ah, you know, I went to grad school, right? You know, right? So we thought that what was the spirit of the moment was actually the inevitable bend of history. And we forgot that actually it takes a long time to inculcate a narrative, right? And Judeo-Christian is probably the single most effective narrative of the last 100 years. I would have said immigrant nation was the single most effective narrative, but that's been upended in the last 10 years, right? But people still walk around talking about Judeo-Christian nation. Actually, I would imagine many, many people in this room are like, yeah, that's passé, but you'd much rather be a Jew or a Catholic in America in 1990 than 1930, right? Mm-hmm. And the way I think about this is continuity is almost always better than massive disruption. And so the way I think about this is a continuous story. What comes next? Judeo-Christian did good work for 80 years. What comes next? And we're in a moment right now where there's a contestation for that.
So civic pluralism sounds like the successor to that, right? Religious and civic pluralism.
I think we play with a lot of things, right? Like, so Interfaith America, uh-huh. You know, the last chapter of my book is called Potluck Nation. We're a nation that welcomes the contributions of people from different backgrounds. You don't have a potluck if people don't contribute. A potluck is boring if people bring the same thing. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants a giant melting machine in front of the potluck door.
Right?
So I think we're playing, and this is, I think, one of the things that's so exciting about working on college campuses is I basically go around the country and say to a bunch of smart 19 to 20 year olds, I have no idea what the next, you know, you don't want to ask the boring 44 year old what the, you know, what the next, the cool new narrative is going to be. Mm-hmm. Come up with something. Figure out how to make it stick.
So, you know, one of the things you talk about in your book is the idea that we need to move beyond just our diversity to a more positive pluralism that's working together for the common good. And yet, to get there, we also need a measure of tolerance and need some safe space. And you know, it's sort of two steps forward, one step back, it feels like. Today, you and I are standing here on a university campus, a Baptist and a Muslim. Today, at North Carolina State University, the president of the Southern Baptist Convention, J.D. Greer, is having a similar kind of from Dallas, Imam Omar Suleiman is having that conversation in North Carolina. And in that case, at least, there is Omar's attempt to say, look, I know I need to talk to evangelicals. I need to push them and ask them what they think of Muslims, because here in Dallas, we know Omar can report, and others who are of the Muslim faith, that there are still protests, armed protests of groups at mosques in Dallas, Texas, that are no longer even reported, but it's just become normal still in Dallas, Texas. So there is a kind of rear flank that we have that we're working on also. Your book, Acts of Faith, tells your story of growing up in America and experiences of dating a Mormon girl and all sorts of things, your own family struggle with all of this. I think it's still really important for those of us who don't encounter this every day to understand something about what it's like to be a Muslim in America today. What could you share with us about your Muslim experience that would help us understand the urgency of this work that we're doing?
Yeah, so I appreciate that question a lot. So I think I want to say two very important kind of caveats before telling, I think, the story that addresses the spirit of that question. One is, look, there's Muslims all over the world who are basically like, how do I get to America? Mm-hmm. For all kinds of reasons. One is economic mobility. The other is religious freedom. This is not to cast any aspersion on Muslim-majority nations or nations in which there are lots and lots of Muslims, like India. It's just to say, like, the Islamophobia that is infecting America right now is ugly, and America is still one of the best places to be Muslim in the world, right? I don't want to say that by way of complacency. I almost always want to tell a story of, look at how far we've come. What does the next chapter look like? I happen to think most of those stories are true. I also think that that's the best way social change happens, right? It is very rare that a revolution totally upends an order and you have the perfect new order that replaces it, right? That only happens in scripture, you know, and not always.
You know what I mean? Yeah.
So I would much rather kind of tell the dimensions of the story of that there has been, and it's kind of an Obama narrative, right? Like, so there's been a set of important steps forward. That doesn't mean that they've always been forward. There's been plenty of zigzags and steps backwards. But I am very grateful for the people who've gone before. I am in this nation because of them. My experience as an Ismaili Muslim growing up in the 80s and 90s in the western suburbs of Chicago was dramatically easier because of what happened, what other people did 20 years before. And my kids' experience is easier. And let's move forward, right? Because the only way you have a diverse democracy is if you welcome the contributions of people from all backgrounds. Otherwise a democracy doesn't work. And I don't just mean at the voting booth. I mean, like, our civil society, right? So just a very small example. We have friends whose son is in high school who he's required to do volunteer service hours, and the most convenient and friendliest place is a little Muslim group around the way from his house. So he does his volunteer service hours for school, for public school, with them. That's like standard operating procedure in America. That surprises nobody, right? That it is religious groups that not only do volunteering themselves, but create the opportunities for others, whether they are in or not in those groups, right? How do we have more of that? The second caveat I want to make is I just have a ton of class privilege. So, like, my personal life, really, really good. Really, really good, right? My kids' life, 95% good. But they're 9 and 12, and they are they're in formation, as you said, and they're kind of exposed to toxins in the culture in a personal way that I'm just not exposed to. So I'll tell you a story. So both my boys played baseball and basketball, and dad on Khalil's baseball team, Khalil's my 9-year-old, says, hey, our boys were having the best conversation in the backseat of the car the other day. It was about religion, and they were three different religions represented, and they were talking about, you know, this dad happened to know that were Muslim. You know, they were talking about like places they worship and what prayer was like and their religious holidays, etc. And my 9-year-old's a pretty good baseball player, but if he had pitched a no-hitter and hit a grand slam in the same game, I wouldn't have been as proud as, you know, he was part of this interfaith conversation. I'm just that kind of nerd, you know? And so I asked Khalil that night, I'm like, you know, what were you talking about with Sam and Ian? He was like, oh, Sam's Jewish and Ian is Christian, and I was saying, you know, where do you go for prayer and how do you pray and what do you call God and you know, what's your religious text called and what's your religious holidays? And I'm like, I am so proud of you, Khalil, that, you know. And I'm saying, what did you tell him about us? About us being Muslim, smiling Muslims. And he looked at me, he's like, nothing. I'm like, nothing? Right, like we pray every night, right? I talk about this stuff for a living, right? We're involved in the intellectual dimensions of Islam, like, you know, the fact that some of the first, you know, 25% of the slaves who came here were Muslim. I mean, Muslims have been here since the very beginnings, et cetera, et cetera. My dad, and Khalil looks at me and says, your dad, right? Didn't say you, he says, dad. Sam is Jewish and Ian is Christian. And Christians and Jews are Americans and Muslims are different. I'm not talking about being Muslim.
Wow.
Right? So this is a 9-year-old growing up in a family of not just proud, but like public Muslims. Mm-hmm. Right? Like my wife is a civil rights attorney. She's a public figure. I do what I do. This 9-year-old kid is like absorbed the toxins in the culture. Right? And he like, he knows how to navigate with that. What am I supposed to do? Say, actually, you can talk about it. Right? He is an expert on his 9-year-old world.
Yeah. As painful as that experience is, or as reflective of where we are, is there a way for you to think about the particularism that represents and see that as a way to talk about the fact that in our pluralist country, in the way we want it to be, we also want to be proud about our particularism,
yeah.
Right? Not, I mean, he was struggling with his Americanism because he's a Muslim, and that's where we need to get to, right? Is that, you know, I've said, I think you've written this as well. The real test case for our principles in America today of religious liberty are whether Muslims flourish publicly as well. So, how do we take those experiences of disenfranchisement or otherness and turn them with our families and friends into a more positive pluralism?
Yeah, so I don't have a direct answer to that question, but I want to be blunt about something that is, I don't know, that doesn't fit neatly into a category, but why am I not that worried? Because my kids' class privilege will overcome that. Right?
What?
It's just, I mean, like, I just want to be blunt, right? Yeah. Like, I'm a Rhodes Scholar. My wife is an attorney who's argued 15 cases in federal court. We live in a nice house in a good school district. That doesn't mean that, like, ugly Islamophobia won't get to my kid, but it won't be through his teachers. Mm-hmm. It won't be through official channels. Mm-hmm. If some coach were to ever say something ugly, 100 other coaches would dissent. And it's just straight class privilege,
yeah.
Right? And so that doesn't mean that from ages 9 to 18 aren't going to be challenging Mm-hmm. And of course, things can get a lot darker on the government level and the structural level, right? But you know, my dad was in India when the Muslim ban goes into effect. Mm-hmm. Okay, but my dad has an MBA from Notre Dame, and he speaks English without an accent, and that's just a whole different scenario when you arrive at immigration. Mm-hmm. Right. It just is. Right, and so there are 100 layers to this. By the way, this just means that I don't lose hours and hours and hours and hours of sleep over my own kids. Now, that girl who wears hijab in Elgin, right, whose parents are from Somalia, mm-hmm. and whose dad works in a factory, that's a lot different. That's a lot different.
Good. What are your questions? Comments.
Linda. But Linda's question was we are learning through psychology and neuroscience how our brains work when it comes to prejudice, right? And part of this is a strong us-them-ness, so a strong preference for like groups and also dominant groups. But what you were specifically speaking about was availability bias and prejudice. And so, you know, back to my son for a story. So my son has a friend whose dad is watching TV, sees an incident of terrorism that happened to be committed by people who call themselves Muslims, and says at the TV, this is reported to my son by his friend who's there, what's wrong with these Muslims, right? That's a perfect example of availability bias, which is basically, if all you know about Muslims are the people who commit terrorist incidents, you basically extrapolate from a very small subset of people to the entire community and tradition. And there's lots of reasons why we don't do the same thing when it comes to terrorists of other stripes, because you have lots of examples of, you know, white people or Christians. And so that handful of white people who become supremacist terrorists or Christians who are part of the Christian identity movement, you don't think of them as representative. And this is happening subconsciously in our brains, right? So this isn't a choice. And I think the part of that is so striking is you have to do work. You have to do mental work, right, to unwind how availability bias works in your brain and to replace it with other images, which is why my wife and I are like, you know, we're going to go to American Medina at the Chicago History Museum. You are going to be filled with examples of the positive contributions of Muslims to America. But the truth of the matter is it's just never going to be as much as the examples on the evening news, right? Unless you're totally, you operate largely within the Muslim community, which frankly we don't, right? So it takes a lot of mental work to say, that is true, but it's not representative. It's not like that didn't happen. It's just not representative. And minority groups are especially susceptible to this. Groups that are unfairly represented are susceptible to this, right? And so that's, and it's not the only kind of way our brains work. Our brains have evolved. Ezra Klein in his new book, Why We're Polarized, has this great line. He's like, look, we live in urban industrial civilizations, moving towards internet virtual ones, but our brains are still stuck in a tribal evolutionary mindset, right? Our brains have not evolved in neuroscience as rapidly as the civilization and culture.
I'm standing here thinking, though, how even in some other of our religious traditions, how often we have to say to our kids and to our congregations, we're not that kind of Baptist also, you know, and we have to do the mental work with them too. We're not those kind of Jews. We're not those kind of whatever, right? Nancy.
We're overcoming our biases and the ways that our brains are being hijacked by media and other, you know, forces in our culture. So how are you working with students on that? Is that, I mean, the getting to know one another process is really important, but it's just not enough right now, right? Because our judicial system is falling apart as we speak.
Yeah, that's a, so thank you. It's a very perceptive question, and a statement and question. So first of all, I think that basically I'm an optimist. So, but to go two clicks into my optimism, I'm an optimist about the interaction of America's governmental structure, separation of powers, et cetera, with its civil society structures like BJC, like Faith Forward, like Thanksgiving Square, that the interaction of those things protect us against some of the worst excesses. That's not something I take for granted. I'm just an optimist about it, right? So I am, and I'm enormously grateful for those things. I'm enormously grateful for the people who showed up on the evening of the Muslim ban saying Muslims welcome. I'm enormously grateful for all the lawsuits that have been filed, you know, against the Trump administration around things like the Muslim ban from state, from the attorneys general in states, in, you know, Washington State and Hawaii, et cetera, to the work that the BJC, et cetera, do, right? So I don't take it for granted. I'm just enormously grateful for it. And it's why I write checks. It's why I say prayers of gratitude. Thank you, Amanda. Thank you, Jamie. Thank you to everybody for that kind of work, right? So that's the first thing. The second thing is, what do we do at IFYC? So I think we do a couple things. And our kind of place in this ecosystem is to, I think, first of all, raise the question of narrative. What is the story that we are telling? And we're obviously not alone in this. You know, Amanda's talk, Christians Against Christian Nationalism, is raising the question of narrative, right? The emergence of Baptist houses raising the question of narrative, which is to say, how are we understanding the broader myth that we are living into, okay? So that's a part of what we do at IFYC by saying things like, what comes after Judeo-Christian? By saying things like, we're a potluck nation, not a melting pot. I think there's two other key things that we do. One is we work with college campuses, which is why I'm so excited to be at SMU, to help them be models of interfaith cooperation, right? How does the campus serve as a laboratory for this? The way that students interact here, the courses that are taught, the articulation of what a Methodist university in the South is. I mean, I think that the existence of Baptist House at the Perkins School of Theology, I just think that's remarkable. It's remarkable, right? What we think about this literally from first year orientation to crossing the stage of graduation. If you are a student at SMU, do you acquire interfaith literacy? Do you build interfaith friendships? Are you given opportunities for interfaith leadership? Do you hear the term interfaith leadership? Is it a part of your education? We think that this is part of the definition of being an educated person. It's like writing well. It's like algebra. Do you see, right? And we work with campuses, kind of freshman orientation to senior seminar and commencement. How is this just a part of the water? Right? You shouldn't graduate college if you've never heard of Toni Morrison. You shouldn't graduate college if you don't know about Roger Williams and the Fletcher Demonstrants. Okay? And then the final thing we do is we invite young people to be interfaith leaders. And so we tell the history of the evolution of American religiosity, and we say what comes after Judeo-Christian. And what does it look like to view yourself as a leader of an interfaith service and dialogue project? And so, you know, there's folks from TCU who've come to our Interfaith Leadership Institute in Chicago. We do this every August. It's a 3-day network building, community building, and training where people go back to their campuses. Students go back to their campuses, and they lead interfaith service and dialogue projects. And we say, you're becoming a civic leader in this. We also want you to think of yourself as a narrative leader. So that's kind of our place in this ecosystem. You know, I love what the BJC does in advocacy vis-a-vis the Supreme Court, and certainly in education as well. We view ourselves as kind of squarely within the civic structure of this kind of stuff.
We have time for just one more question, and then we need to wrap up to give him time to get up to that. Kevin.
Are things getting better or worse, and why? Yeah.
I don't. I mean, look. I'm an optimist. Here's the question that I started asking, like a month after the election in 2016, after I got out of bed. You know, was what does the day after the day after look like? So if you win your revolution, how do you build a better order? And for 2 years, that was not a popular thing to say on college campuses. I was, you know, not quite booed down by my own folks, but it was not a popular thing to say, right? And in my own experience, and I think we're seeing this in other parts of our society, the people who are asking the question, what does a better order look like, and what's the path to that better order? And be very, very wary of the promise of revolutions. Be very wary of those things. You know, Shireen Ebadi just wrote a piece in the Washington Post where Shireen Ebadi, the Iranian Nobel Prize winner, she apologized for supporting the Iranian Revolution to her daughters. So I just want to underscore this. Right? Here is an Iranian jurist, Nobel Prize winner, okay, doesn't wear a headscarf, liberal Muslim, et cetera, et cetera. She supported the Iranian Revolution in 1979. She was like, let's destroy everything and just trust that the new order will be that much better. And it's not. Right? So I throw in with people who are continually asking the question, what does a better order look like? What does a better order look like? Not what does a more furious revolution look like? I'm not making a statement about our contemporary politics. I'm making a statement about the energy that I see in civil society, right? And I am seeing much more of a build a better order energy. And a lot of this for me is like, some of it's analysis, but it's like I'm just temperamentally moderate, right? And I would much rather ask the question, how wide is my circle rather than how bright is my line, right? And when I would say that a year ago, people would be like, dude, like, you know, the small group is meeting over there, you know? Like, we're here for the revolution, you know? And I think that I feel a different energy now. So that makes me hopeful. But honestly, if I didn't feel that, I'd find another reason to be hopeful. So
let me just say as we conclude how hopeful I am as well in Dallas, Texas.
Yes.
That we have the Baptist House that has come up in this moment. Faith Commons, we want to play this part. Faith Forward Dallas has emerged. In all the years that Nancy and I have been here, more than 30 now, we have not seen the level of interfaith and multi-faith cooperation that exists now in Dallas. It has not been the case. This is beginning to change the culture in Dallas that has been Christian hegemonist for a long time and is becoming more self-conscious in our interfaith responsibilities and outreach. So thank you all very much for being here, Ibu. We couldn't be more grateful that you've been with us. God bless you all.
That was Ibu Patel and George Mason on March 5th, speaking on the campus of SMU in Dallas, Texas. You can watch a video of this conversation and videos of the other two presentations Dr. Patel gave on our website. Visit bjconline.org/Sherdin Lectures or check out BJC's YouTube channel.
And that brings us to the close of this episode of Respecting Religion. Thanks for inviting us into your home or your earbuds during this time of social distancing. Be sure to join us Thursday for our next episode in this podcast series. You can see a list of all of them on our website. Visit bjconline.org/respectingreligion.
And subscribe to the BJC podcast so you don't miss an episode. We're on all the major platforms. Let us know what you think of the podcast on social media. We're on Twitter and Instagram at BJC on the Hill. And you can follow me on Twitter at Amanda Tyler BJC.
And get to know us. Visit our website at bjconline.org to see how we've been working for faith freedom for all since 1936. And join us again next week for a new conversation, Respecting Religion.